from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and I'm going to talk about something that sounds a little provocative when I put it this way. I'm going to talk about war with Venezuela. And I'm sure some of you are like, what? We declared war on Venezuela? No, we have not declared war on Venezuela. And frankly, under U.S. law, the Congress is supposed to declare wars. We haven't declared a war since World War II, so I won't get into all that. But what I'm going to talk about is the growing series of U.S. military strikes that have taken place on a variety of vessels coming from Venezuela, also in the Eastern Pacific. And just for geography thing, Venezuela does not touch the Eastern Pacific, but they're tied to drug cartels, which we have designated as terrorist groups. Some of them we've hit fast boats, which is just what it sounds like. They're boats that go really fast. And then these semi-submersibles, which kind of look like a submarine, but they don't actually fully submerge. The conning tower and some other stuff stays above the surface, but they're very low profile, very difficult to see in the ocean, perfect for smuggling drugs. And so we've been hitting those in the Caribbean and East Pacific. And what appears to be, and what could very well be soon, a series of strikes on the territory of Venezuela. And this would be aimed at the drug cartels, which, again, we have designated as international terrorist groups. So let me start talking about that. Now, sitting off the coast of Venezuela in the Caribbean, we have a very large military armada or naval armada out there, I should say. About 10 to 15% of our ships afloat or currently deployed, I should say, are sitting really off the coast of Venezuela, doing a variety of workup operations and things like that. One of the biggest things is a Marine Expeditionary, a sizable but not an enormous organization, a couple thousand Marines broken into a ground combat element, an aviation element, a command element, and then a logistics element. The ground combat element is basically built around a infantry battalion, which is less than, what, 700-750 troops. So it's not if you're talking about going against a nation with thousands or tens of thousands of troops, very capable, can do a lot of stuff, but just in sheer manpower, it's not that big of a force. But, certainly to look at it, it's a pretty big force. And then they're being joined by aircraft or aircraft carrier task force, the Gerald R. Ford, which is one of our newest carriers, very capable. Now, along with that, we have a squadron of F-5 fighter bombers. That's a stealth-capable fighter bomber sitting up in Puerto Rico at Roosevelt Roads Naval Base. And the FAA just announced that there's a huge chunk of territory, or I should say airspace, southeast of Puerto Rico that they want civil aircraft to avoid because of military aircraft activity, which is something one would expect if you were seeing or expecting a large number of aircraft military strike missions taking place in that part of the world. The U.S. has flown strategic bombers near Venezuela. Of course, we have B-52s, we have B-2s, we also have B-1 bombers. We have a variety of different bombers that we can use, and we have been reminding Venezuela that we have this unique capability that they don't have, nor does anybody else have in the Western Hemisphere with that. And so we have put a lot of stuff. This is putting enormous pressure on the Maduro regime. It is certainly putting wind in the sails of the opposition to the Maduro regime. And we have also said the Maduro regime, or Nicolas Maduro himself, is kind of a kingpin in the Solas cartel, which is one of the cartels, one of the biggest cartels down there, and the one of the cartels that we have designated as a terrorist group or an international terrorist group. And so that makes, by definition, Maduro, as a kingpin of this cartel, a terrorist leader, if you will. And so that kind of opens up some things that could be done to him personally. Now, Tren de Aragua is probably the more famous of the cartels down there. A lot of talk about that. Tren de Aragua has a footprint in the United States as well. And so that's another terrorist group that we've been targeting down there. To date, about 15 vessels, although this seems to be changing on a daily basis, have been struck. About 64 plus people, probably close to 70 now, getting up to 70, have been killed. At least three have been rescued at sea from these strikes. The basic reality, though, I should mention is that there's a lot of discussion. You know, some of the mothers of those killed or were rescued say, "Oh no, my son was out there innocently doing fishing." Okay, let me just explain a couple things. If they're in a semi-submersible, they're not fishing. There is no fishing semi-submersible. The semi-submersibles were developed for one purpose: smuggling. Smuggling drugs. They are low profile on the water, very difficult to pick up visually or with a variety of other systems, and they're cheap to make, relatively cheap to make. Most of them are just one-time vessels. They do the load, and they're so cheap that they just simply scuttle them, sink them after the load has been transferred to shore, and that's what they are. They're a drug smuggling boat, so there is nothing. In fact, one of the problems was they get stopped at sea, and they would pop the hatch. The crew would come out, and as they're leaving, they'd scuttle the boat, so the semi-submersible. So the semi-submersible and the load of drugs would all sink to the bottom of the ocean, where it was largely unrecoverable, which made it difficult to prosecute the crew. So they actually made simply being a crew member on a semi-submersible a felony. So if they do surrender, we will end up sticking them in prison simply for crewing a semi-submersible. And we've seen these out there in the Caribbean extensively. They cross the Atlantic, going all the way up to Europe and into West Africa. And we've seen them shooting all the way across from South America, across the Pacific. So they're widely used, but there is no legitimate reason that I'm aware of for these things. Although they are effective in being very difficult to see, so effective that the Marine Corps has looked at using these similar types of semi-submersibles in the Pacific as a logistics resupply vessel for its stay-behind forces. And they actually may do that with artificial intelligence and make them self-driving logistics resupply craft. So who knows? A lot of things going on there. You've also probably seen that they've used fast boats. Now, when you see these pictures of these boats getting blown up, you may notice that they're not a huge boat, but they've got about three or four very large outboard engines on the back with a tremendous amount of horsepower, and they can go 40, 50, 60 plus knots, 65 knots. Some, it just depends on the sea state, really. And they're zipping across the ocean at night. Now, again, if you look at the pictures or the imagery, you're not going to see fishing poles or nets or any fish in the boat. What you will see are bales of what looks like cocaine. And that's because they are bales of cocaine. So this idea that they are fishing boats, there's just simply nothing there to really support that concept. All right. They're drug smuggling boats. That's what they are. And by the way, that's the main way that the maritime route is the main way drugs get smuggled from down south up north to North America to the U.S. So when we're interdicting these things, whether it's these semi-submersibles or these fast boats, particularly down south and not close to the U.S. waterways, but down south, that makes a huge dent on the revenue stream for the drug cartels. That's a big hit that we're doing. All legal issues of strike first, ask questions later, so to speak, aside, that is a very effective tool in cutting down the amount of drugs making it to the United States. Now, our position is that these drug cartels are killing tens of thousands, 100,000 Americans every year, and that they are dangerous organizations, which they are. And if you want to go back in history, they have done some pretty horrible stuff. You go down to Mexico, you will find that they use drones to do attacks, just like Russia or any other country around the world uses drones to do attack, just like ISIS was using drones to do attack. They have armored vehicles. They use roadside bombs, IEDs. All the typical terrorist tradecraft, if you will, are emulated by these terrorist groups. They have done terrorist bombings where they do a bombing for political purposes to impact the civilian population or the government. They have brought down at least one airliner in Colombia for political purposes, taking out I believe it was a presidential candidate. And they've assassinated candidates. So, and that's all over, not just down in Colombia, but that's all over South America. We've seen that in Central America. So they definitely certain in terms of what they do, in terms of the tactics, if you will, and their strategy, they look a lot like terrorist groups. So that's not a far-fetched thing to say that they are terrorist groups, because they rule by inflicting terror on the population, all right? They're not typical of what we've seen since 9/11. They're certainly not Al-Qaeda-affiliated, ISIS, although they have been hiring, a number of these groups have been hiring Hezbollah for years to help train them and help them with money laundering and a bunch of other stuff. So they have been associated with Middle Eastern groups that are Islamic extremist, if you will, groups, terrorist groups, and using them for mostly for business purposes, if you will, but other things too. And I would remind anybody just to do a little bit of history on that to take a look at what's going on. If you look in El Salvador, which now El Salvador isn't as bad, but the way they do it was pretty draconian. They just went out and swooped up this huge number of gang members throughout the country, you know, tattooed from top of their head down to their toes, and put them in these maximum security prisons. And there's been a lot of questions about how they've done that and to the degree that they've done that and whether they circumvented proper jurisprudence in doing that. But it did really dramatically reduce the amount of crime on the streets. And so, but go back some years, look at what was happening in El Salvador with the violence in there. And you'd say, yeah, it's a terror state, if you will. Right. Now the U.S. has these huge array of forces arrayed against Venezuela. But I would also remind everyone that the U.S. does not consider Nicolas Maduro, the president, the de facto president, I should say, of Venezuela, as a legitimately elected president. He lost the election. I don't know if he lost by, you know, 2/3 went for the opposition or 3/4 went for the opposition, but it was a really, really high number. It was not even close that he came in there, and he just simply rigged it through his government offices to make it look like he won the election, which he did not win the election. All right. We also have a $50 million bounty on Maduro to stand charges tied to drug smuggling. All right. It's actually a little bit more involved than that. But yeah, we have criminal charges on Maduro, even though he thinks he's a foreign head of state, but we don't think he's a legitimate foreign head of state. Now, why is this important? Well, I would point out something. This year's Nobel Peace Prize recipient was Maria Corina Machado in Venezuela. She had been a candidate for president. She was basically, they did some things to force her out of that candidacy. So her number two took over and was actually technically, which was legitimately elected in the president. And the interesting thing is that it may be with what the U.S. is doing that we set the foundation for the opposition eventually coming to power in Venezuela. If the military pressure and everything we're doing forces Maduro out of office, the opposition may come to power. It's not inconceivable at some point in the future that Maria Corina Machado could end up becoming the president of Venezuela. And look, President Trump has not been particularly secretive about his desire to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And so if he actually puts this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner into power in Venezuela, I think that's going to be something kind of interesting that the Nobel Committee is going to have to consider, you know, along with all these other, you know, things that have happened around the world. I just find that rather fascinating. And I don't know if that's weighing in on his thinking at all. Maybe it is. All right. But the U.S., with all the clandestine capabilities we have, and certainly the overt military capability we have, putting tremendous pressure on Maduro, putting pressure on his regime. I think that that what he's doing there could probably be a major factor in eventually his getting the Nobel Peace Prize. That's I don't rule that out. All right. Now, what kind of strikes would the U.S. pursue? Well, Anything tied to the drug trade is pretty much a good rule of thumb. Anything tied to the cartels, these cartels have been designated terrorist groups, their entire supply chain, their leadership structure. By the way, Maduro has been identified as a kingpin in a narco-terrorist cartel. So kind of technically, possibly Maduro could be targeted. And I would say it's worth noting that under U.S. law, it is an executive order that prohibits us from, assassinating foreign heads of state. And President Trump could turn around and make an exception to that if he wanted to, since it's an executive order. Anything tied to the Venezuelan military and security forces could be potential targets. Basically, anything that props up the Maduro regime and enables the drug trade, which by definition is pretty much the military and security forces. They all enable the drug trade, hence they enable terrorism. Now, the U.S. forces are arrayed down there, a huge amount. If we were to suddenly pull out the amphibious ready group, the Marine Expeditionary Unit that's aboard those ships, the carrier task force, if we were simply to precipitously pull out, Maduro would certainly claim that was a victory. He would say, chase the Americans away, that the power of his regime and everything, and that's something that the U.S. realizes he's going to do. It would look bad for us, and image perception can be reality. Image is important. We can't keep those forces down there forever. So another way of saying there's a very, very, very high chance that we're going to do strikes in Venezuela, simply because the alternative of pulling our forces out of Venezuela or out of Venezuelan, the region of Venezuela, would probably be worse than actually doing something in Venezuela. All right. So I do think that is, when you look at U.S. foreign policy, that's something I have to consider. We have bigger fish to fry in the Western Hemisphere. We have issues to deal with places like Brazil, places like Colombia to consider. We've just stated that the head of Colombia is tied to the drug trade as well. We have kind of made it clear that we think that there are members of the Mexican government that are tied to the drug trade. So there's a lot of reasons why we may want to make a point with Venezuela. The Venezuelan military looks impressive on paper, but the reality is, from a capability standpoint, they're kind of a hollow force, if you will. They are rife with corruption, particularly at the upper levels. They are the most rank-heavy military probably in the entire world. That's one of the way Maduro maintains loyalty of them, is to give them higher paying, high rank jobs. Just unbelievable unchecked cronyism and just not a complete lack of professionalism, if you will. They're a military that's much more comfortable going after protesters on the streets of Caracas than they are going after any invading military force or anything like that. So in short, it shouldn't take a lot of real military pressure on that organization to start finding seams, cracks, fissures, gaps, if you will, in their cohesion and their ability to maintain themselves in terms of good order and discipline. And with that, they a lot of pressure, they might start to fall apart. And this is they're basically there to prop up the regime. They're not there to fight foreign armies or foreign forces. So very good chance that this pressure campaign could work without us doing too much, if you will, within Venezuela. Now, as such, despite President Trump's statement when he was asked, are we doing an imminent strike against Venezuela? He said, no. Well, despite that, it is virtually inconceivable that we don't have plans on the table of places to strike. And certainly, if you look at what the president said earlier, he indicated that we were looking at doing strikes, or I should say there was information coming from the administration that we're looking at doing strikes in Venezuela. And therefore, I would be surprised if we haven't developed a rather robust target list of places and looked at a lot of intelligence to figure out what we'd want to hit. And of course, once making a statement that we might hit them, we're going to watch it even more closely to see if they move so we can find out a new location where they're set up at. And so the dynamics of this situation really overall dictate that the U.S. will almost certainly have to do something along those lines. The exception would be if Maduro was to flee, kind of like Bashar al-Assad in Syria, or if he was simply to be overthrown. That would give us what we need to leave, have our forces withdrawn from the Venezuela region. But short of that, I don't know that we're going to have a reason to do that. And there's a lot of reasons, you know, particularly if we have covert or clandestine capabilities, which by definition are covert and clandestine. So, you know, we're not going to find out about them until probably something happens. There's a lot of good reasons why we may want to keep those forces in place and then do something to put, you know, overwhelming pressure on the Maduro regime. Hey, thanks for listening to Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, STRAT. Obviously, you can find STRAT just about anywhere you can find podcasts, but go to stratpodcast.com. Go to the STRAT Podcast YouTube channel. And, of course, the Hal Kempfert TV YouTube channel if you want to see many of my numerous appearances on various television news shows and networks. And you can always go to our corporate website at www.gripsa.com. Thank you.